Evident Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this May the 17th on the West Coast, now May the 18th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. We'd like to also welcome those listening in on Wind Talkers Radio Network and appreciate you helping us spread the word. Well, lots of disinformation going on. They found computer files in Pakistan, and they're trying to ramp up the fear now on this is going to happen and that's going to happen. And isn't it coincidental that while they're getting ready to run all kinds of nuclear exercises in the United States along the New Madrid Fault, Benjamin Netanyahu from Israel is going to spend some time here, maybe up to a week. Don't you find that interesting? Very, very interesting. And I'm going to stick by my comments from the show last night and from last Friday in regard to what happened in Japan and what is going on in Japan currently. More fear-monger fodder for the masses coming through the mainstream media. Tonight, I don't have a guest, as I mentioned last night, and we're going to continue on this saga called Jack Parsons and the Curious Origins of the American Space Program. Right now, though, we're going to put it into cruise control. Thank you. from Tower Power, written by Greg Adams, trumpeter and flugelhornist extraordinaire. That was Cruise Control. Gets you kind of in the mood for tonight. I'm going into part four of the piece written by the magician, and it's called Jack Parsons and the Curious Origins of the American Space Program. Now, in the first three parts of this essay, you could say it's really like a book, but we'll call it an essay. And sort of recap the fact that the rocket scientist, Jack Parsons, was a follower of Aleister Crowley, and he started a church in Glendale, California. And it was determined that there were some strange goings on with this church. And while that was going on, Parsons was partially responsible with a few other rocket scientists in founding what became known as JPL, or Jet Propulsion Laboratory. In fact, it was established at the end of the street where Parsons lived. And there is an investigation going on, and we're hearing this through the eyes and mouth and ears of the magician. Part four, Abreaction Therapy. There was no payphone at the Palladium, a restaurant on the University of Penn campus, but they let me use the house phone at the end of the bar. I told Sherry about the books Wilson had mentioned and asked her to get me a direct flight to Los Angeles. I felt a stare as she turned. The man was wearing a black suit and sitting on one of the high wooden bar stools. Someone had apparently replaced his blood with embalming fluid, and it still annoyed him. The deep-set eyes in the greenish-gray flesh stared without blinking. He stood up and moved toward me. "Have the time?" the mouth asked. "It's 2:30, I guessed. "You lie," he affirmed with some belligerence. "It's 4:15. He glared at me before turning and shuffling out the door to Locust Walk. When I followed a few moments later, he had disappeared. I went back into the Palladium and dialed the time. It was 2:33. Then I tried the number Homer Nilmont had given me. "Transglobal Consultants," the woman answered. She said Mr. Nilmont was out, but she would relay my message. When I got back to the office, Sherry told me she had gotten a flight reservation for the day after tomorrow. "Just enough time to tie up some loose ends," I said. I told her about the walking stiff I had met at the Palladium. "Sounds like one of my two men in black," Sherry responded. "The one from the cemetery," she said gravely. "Well, this was definitely an actor from a Renegool. Who are these men in black supposed to be again? Maybe that's the point of this little charade, to create distraction. The classic men in black are the bad guys of the Space Brother world," Sherry said. "Traditionally, they're tanned or olive-skinned individuals with high cheekbones, faintly oriental in appearance, often driving black Cadillacs or Buicks or something, and who appear to people who have had UFO experiences and threaten them to keep quiet about whatever has happened. Or sometimes they show up in the guise of Zist or Air Force agents, take down full reports of the victim's experiences, and tell him the military is conducting an investigation. Except if the investigators are investigated, their credentials often turn out to be bogus. Experiences with men in black may be, incidentally, the reason General Carl Spatz, our first Air Force Chief of Staff, announced at a press conference in 1948, "There is no truth to the rumors that the flying saucers are from Spain or that they are piloted by Spaniards." I thought about that. Well, that doesn't fit this fellow, I said. He didn't have the slightest hint of a suntan, and I haven't seen any UFOs lately. Me neither, said Sherry. I guess we don't qualify to be among the chosen few. She curled out her lower lip in a pout. There was something bothering me about what happened at the Palladium. It seemed, well, familiar. Give me a Men in Black example, I asked Sherry. Something early, maybe. Something classic. You know, before the media and the hype took over. Easy, she said. There was Albert Bender. He closed down his International Flying Saucer Bureau in 1953. He said three men wearing black suits were responsible. Most amateur ufologists concluded it was government agents who had put pressure on him. It was another 10 years before Bender told the full account in his book, Flying Saucers and the Three Men. Bender's three men weren't your average government bureaucrats. No, sir. They had glowing eyes. They materialized and dematerialized in his apartment. They took him to a secret UFO base in Antarctica, and so on. So it was likely a hypnotic experience, I said, an extended mind beep, or whatever, Sherry said. He exhibited the usual symptoms from contact, upset stomach, loss of appetite, headaches, lacunar amnesia. It came to me, then, what had been bothering me about the Palladium ghoul. It took a little digging through the files, but we found it soon enough. It was a paper entitled The Confusion Technique in Hypnosis by the hypnotherapist Milton H. Erickson. It was published in the American Journal of Clinical Hypnosis in 1964. Erickson gives an example of the technique in action. A man came rushing around the corner of a building and bumped hard against me as I stood bracing myself against the wind. Before he could recover his poise to speak to me, I glanced elaborately at my watch and courteously, as if he had inquired the time of day, I stated, "It's exactly 10 minutes of 2, though it was actually closer to 4 p.m., and walked on. About a half a block away, I turned and saw him still looking at me, undoubtedly still puzzled and bewildered by my remark. Erickson goes on to explain that the technique works through the use of vague and puzzling statements. Because of the initial confusion, the hypnotic subject will then treat the first clearly understandable piece of information as unusually important. Maybe they're softening up our minds now, I said to Sherry. They're getting ready to stick it to us. Whoever they are, Sherry said. I asked Sherry to keep trying Homer Neilmott's number. Meanwhile, I made myself a cup of coffee and sat down to study the theory of sex magic in William Sargent's The Mind Possessed. David Wilson had let me borrow his copy, which I gladly accepted. Returning it would give me an excuse to talk to him again. According to Sargent, there is a general physiological mechanism for reprogramming behavior. It involves the creation of intense emotion, such as fear or anger, leading up to a collapse from emotional exhaustion. Sargent originally studied soldiers who were having mental difficulties stemming from traumatic war experiences. It turned out such problems could generally be alleviated through a drug-induced emotional experience of sufficient intensity to lead to a general physical collapse. Sargent called it an abreactive experience. After the patient had come around, Sargent wrote, he might burst into tears or shake his head and smile and then report that all his previous fears and abnormal preoccupations had suddenly left him, that his mind was functioning more normally again, that he felt more like his old self, that memories which had obsessed and terrified him could now be thought of without fear or anxiety. It was not necessary to relive the original experience, just to generate the emotional collapse. The mind, according to Sargent, subsequently became pliable to new programming, new behavior and attitudes, just as it apparently had been when the original problems were implanted. Drugs were only one method for inducing the collapse. Music and dancing was another. So was terror induced by hellfire preaching, or a holy roller atmosphere of music and confession and induction of the Holy Ghost, or electroconvulsive therapy, or exhaustion through repeated sexual orgasm. The collapse could serve the purpose of a general release from worries, guilts, obsessions, and sins. But one also became open to new ideas, Sargent claimed. One could become a new man or woman, for good or evil, in the service of the gods, the flag, or the self. In sexual magic, the trance is induced through sexual exhaustion. Sargent quotes Aleister Crowley, the magician himself, on the details. The candidate is made ready for the ordeal by general athletic training and by fasting. On the appointed day, he is attended by one or more experienced attendants whose duty it is to exhaust him sexually by every known means. The candidate will sink into a sleep of utter exhaustion, but he must again be again sexually stimulated and then again allowed to fall asleep. This alternation is to continue indefinitely until the candidate is in a state which is neither sleep nor waking and which his spirit is set free by perfect exhaustion of the body and communes with the most highest and the most holy Lord God of its being, maker of heaven and earth. I called Sherry back in and read the passage to her. So basically, you screw your brains out until you see visions and talk to God and the angels, she summarized. That seemed to be pretty much it. With the help of experienced attendants, I noted. It probably induces a change in the brain's hormonal balance, but obviously there are more techniques than just the one Sargent mentions here. For example, when Jack Parsons and Marjorie Cameron were engaged in ritual intercourse, it was L. Ron Hubbard who was communing with the Most High. Ron the Seer, right? Sounds like a complex subject. If you want the whole technology, perhaps you should go to the source. She laid a book on my desk. It was Crowley's Magic in Theory and Practice. I groaned inwardly. This wasn't what I wanted to spend my time on. I just had the vague hope that I could get into Parsons' mindset. It might help me find out who killed him. It was a comforting belief, since it was all I had to go on at the moment. But getting into Parsons' mindset was turning out to be a complex process. I studied Sherry's posture. She was sitting with her feet propped up, the hem of her skirt slipping well above her knees. She was wearing a silk blouse that clung seductively to her breasts. "You want me to get something to eat after work?" she asked. "I'll buy you a burger and a margarita at the Copacabana." I considered it. The offer was tempting. I was a sucker for fresh lime juice and tequila. I hesitated, though. All my instincts told me not to get too chummy with the help. The phone wouldn't get answered, the research wouldn't get done, the office would fall apart. On the other hand, we were only going to get a hamburger. Why not? Just because she wanted to buy me dinner didn't mean she expected something more for dessert. "Sure," I said, "why don't we go have a margarita?" At Copa, we got a table on the 4th Street side where we could watch the foot traffic at the corner with South. Jimmy Cliff's "The Harder They Come" was booming out over the sound system. As we sipped our drinks, Sherry told me that Albert Bender was also a student of magic. This was going on while Bender was studying UFOs. What happened with respect to the men in black may have only obliquely been related to flying saucers. Magic is a traditional method of conjuring up elementals, and Bender suffered from a lot of poltergeist manifestations. In that case, maybe Jack Parsons was also visited by men in black, I said. Maybe it's all magic, Sherry said. The saucers are just techno veneer. Most of the interesting stuff seems to take place in someone's mind with no witnesses. I watched her tongue lightly lick salt from the rim of the glass before she took a sip of margarita. When I had interviewed Sherry only a couple of months previously, she had claimed she was a Hindu vegetarian who didn't drink, but got stoned frequently. Now here she sat with a drink in her hand, and she had just ordered a hamburger. "No salad tonight?" I asked. She shrugged. "Sometimes, like Fritz Mondale, I ask myself, where's the beef? I get this intense craving for bloody bovine carcass." As long as you don't knock over little old cows in the street to support your habit, or stand on a soapbox preaching the occult virtues of meat eating. No possibility of that, not since I found Bob. Bob says death to all fanatics. She had been a rock groupie, once getting arrested in Miami. She had played guitar for several years, then had switched to electric blues harp and had performed with Muddy Waters. "Bob drinks, you know," she said, her tongue at work on the rim of the glass. "He's drinking buddies with the fighting Jesus. That's the one who comes bringing not peace, but a sword. The macho Jesus, not the wimp who turns the other cheek." So that's why you were reading Wigglesworth, to study up on the fighting Jesus. Once she had rehearsed for the part of Mary Magdalene in Jesus Christ Superstar. Although all in all she preferred Krishna, she said as Krishna could be seen in anyone, including a lover, she had claimed, but that was the last I had ever heard of Krishna. Maybe it's just something you say in a job interview when you don't want to sound like a Jesus fanatic. Nah, American history is cultural edification. Roots, you know. Which reminds me, you want to go to a party tonight? It's called the Mauvais Arts Ball and gets started around 11 o'clock. It's a parody of the Beaux-Arts Ball, the one for arts and architecture, held later in October. Mauvais Arts? If the Beaux-Arts Ball were the semi-orderly formality of a ceremonial dinner dance, then the Mauvais Arts Ball would be the orgy in the back room. It was inspired, I think, by the reviews of bad cinema that Dan Aykroyd used to do on Saturday Night Live. Anyway, this year's theme is apocalypse culture. As in the Four Horsemen? As in the Kali Yuga, Friday the 13th, nuclear winter, the mark of the beast, marrying and giving in marriage, chaos theory, the Society Hill dungeon, rumors of war, the return of Quetzalcoatl, 2001, lycanthropy, famine, the invasion of the bodybuilders, automobile airbags, presidential astrology, AIDS, needles washing up on the beach, earthquakes, sex with robots, psychic warfare, cable TV, all those things. I take it I don't need to wear a tuxedo then. You can wear pretty much anything you want. There will be all the usual artsy crowd there and a lot of pinks and assorted politicos. A couple of fellow sub-genii are scheduled to speak, or rather to rant and rave. It's all part of the atmosphere. Later in the evening, there will be a channeling session delivered by Helen Morley, the avatar of Amargi. Where's Amargi? Amargi is a Sumerian word meaning freedom. That appeared auspicious, sounded like fun, and I said I would go. I worked my way around the bar to the phone, called Trans Global Consultants, and left a message telling Homer Nilmott where I would be. When I returned to the table, I saw a mounted Philadelphia patrolman had stopped just outside the window. From time to time, passersby would pause to pet the horse. All but the better-looking women were told to keep their hands to themselves. I guess the horse was picky. So what did David Wilson at Penn have to say? I told her about Liberaz. Sounds to me pretty much a strong statement about individual rights, Sherry opined. I think the Founding Fathers would have approved. Leave out the love part, maybe. Yeah, whatever happened to politics anyway? Now every political campaign is run as a crusade to solve the world's problems. So, you don't believe in crusades against evil, taking out the bad guys, all that? Sherry's tone was mocking. No, the way I look at it, organized sin and organized sin fighting are two sides of the same corporate coin. It's like the Society Hill Towers resident priest, who has a number of women confess that the grocer's new delivery boy has seduced them. He makes them each put $100 in the poor box. Then the delivery boy appears and the priest asks angrily, "What have you got to say for yourself?" "Just this," the delivery boy replies. "Either you cut me in on those $100 fees, or I take my business to some other parish." "Yeah," Sherry agreed, "you can't get rich saving souls if everyone's converted." Crisis managers couldn't cope without calamity. You can't get elected president without a social problem to fight or a menace to protect people from. Of course, the problems never disappear. The Cossacks are always coming to rape our women and destroy our way of life. And by definition, there will always be people with below average income or whatever. The chief function of government is to find problems that can profitably be managed. Everyone wants to save the world as long as doing so gives them power and as long as someone else pays for it. Why do you think people go into politics anyway? This was getting too serious for discussion over margaritas, I thought. A lot of men go into politics because of the women. Ever been to a major political convention or an election night party? Sexy women everywhere, and there's nothing like working for a noble cause to get them hot and willing. Sherry blushed. I was surprised. "It's niacin," Sherry explained. "I took a 500 milligram capsule a few minutes ago. It creates a skin flush similar to the Masters and Johnson sexual flush." Trisha's recommendation. Niacin reduces serum cholesterol, the fat in your bloodstream. She was a biochemistry major. Sherry decided to change the subject. "The other day I was in Garland of Letters, the New Age bookstore down the street, and these two women were looking at books. And this other woman comes by and says, 'You ladies don't look at that witchcraft. Read your Bible.' 'I read the Bible one time myself,' I said. 'Not Bob's, the other one.' Sherry looked skeptical. 'Really, the baguettes and all. One thing I remember it says is that Satan appears as an angel of light. You don't hear much about that these days. To hear some Christians tell it, Satan has pointed ears, 666 tattooed on his forehead, and dresses in brand name Lucifer leather with an appropriately sized forked codpiece. But their own reference manual says it's the opposite of that. You're saying that if everyone agrees something is evil, it's just as likely not?" "Not exactly. I'm saying that when you find Satan, he'll probably look like Jesus Christ himself. And what does that have to do with Jack Parsons? Or abreaction therapy?" Sherry demanded after a moment's thought. "I have no idea, just something that came to mind." I signaled for the check. And we're going to take just a short pause here. I may move on to part five here since we moved along so quickly, although this is rather descriptive and probably not proper for my radio show, but I'm going to peruse it while we listen here to Earth Run. That was Lee Ritenour from his album Earthrun, the title track, Earthrun. Just one of those things. You know, I was skimming over part five while that was playing, and I determined that it goes off in another tangent. And, of course, there's discussion about drinking drugs of every kind you can imagine, and even the seduction of the magician by Helen Morley, the speaker, who channeled a message to the group. And it's a little bit too much for radio. I read it hoping to find out more about Jack Parsons, but it was just a diversion, I guess. Every book, every movie has to have the obligatory sell you the Tavistock program. So I'm going to move to part six, and this is called Exodus. From the window of his room in the King David Hotel, he could see the walls of Jerusalem's old city on the adjacent hill. The valley lying below, separating him from the Jaffa Gate, was Hinnom, better known as Gehenna or Hell. The prophet Jeremiah had predicted a slaughter in Hinnom, and the name had since become a metaphor for divine punishment. The valley extended to his right southward, then curved eastward around Mount Zion, where it would eventually meet the Kidron Valley below the archaeological ruins of the city of David. Hell isn't so terrible, he thought, just a lot of bad press. The previous night, he hadn't needed to play a role because he had felt like a bloody tourist. He had investigated the hotel bar in search of companionship, but the few girls passing through were Americans primarily interested in New York, Jerusalem, comparative shopping values. Then he had gone to a French restaurant where the service had been adequate, but the entrees were of mediocre quality and flagrantly overpriced. The wine list consisted of a smattering of domestic Israeli varieties that tasted like shoe polish. After he had discovered the management wouldn't accept the local currency, the shekel, in payment, he had to use scarce dollars. Next, he had asked a cab driver to take him somewhere where there was live music, and they had driven several miles in the fog to a club at the top of a mountain where there was a dance floor and a three-piece band. He had sipped a Sabra liqueur and watched a youthful clique who were drinking, dancing, and occasionally retiring outside to smoke hashish. Then she had appeared, and he had forgotten why he was here. "Where did the hotel say to go to hear a live band?" she had asked. "Nowhere, really. They said there wasn't much in Jerusalem because Jerusalem is a holy city. There is a disco or two, but as for live performances other than concerts, it's mostly just tourist shows consisting of folk songs." She had laughed at the peculiar notion of holiness, the musical voice reverberating within the room. In ancient times, what was holy was demarcated by singing and dancing. Primitive religion was mostly about sex, which is the principal affirmation of life, and drugs, which are doorways to another world, the realm of gods, spirits, and the dead. Both are properly experienced in the company of music. At that point, there was no way he would have refused her invitation. She had given him precise instructions. Playing a role? He wasn't sure what he meant by that. Who he was and why he was here kept tugging at the edge of his mind, but whenever he turned his attention in that direction, it flittered away out of grasp. At other times, he had the impression he was someone else, but that, too, made no sense without a clear basis for comparison. Now it was time. He turned from the window to pick up the paper sack, carefully closed the door of the room behind him, and walked down the red-carpeted stairs from the fourth floor. He pushed through the revolving door of the lobby, declining the doorman's offer of a taxi, and glanced briefly at the YMCA across the street before turning right down David Hamelech. After a while, he turned to his right again into a street that descended between rows of one- and two-story abandoned buildings before rising up to the outer wall of the old city. A stray cat ventured out of the rubble of a building into the edge of the sunlight. He paused to speak to it, glancing carefully back up the street as he did so. Then, as the cat scrambled away, he stepped into the dark interior of the stone structure and waited quietly for a few minutes. Cars passed occasionally in either direction, but there was nothing else. He emptied the sack and quickly donned a cloth made from coarse brown cloth. Then he folded a kufiyah and fitted it on his head with an akal made of stiff rope. He crossed Yafo, entered Jaffa Gate, and joined a stream of similarly clad figures headed down the narrow passageways of David and Chain Streets, which were also crowded with merchants, shoppers, tourists, and soldiers. The Islamic faithful, on their way to prayer, would pass on through the gate of the chain entrance to the Haram es Sharif, the Temple Mount, where they would enter the western door to the Dome of the Rock. There, beside the foundation stone where Abraham had prepared to sacrifice Isaac, and from which Muhammad had ascended to heaven, they would kneel with heads pointed southward toward Mecca. Shortly before reaching the gate of the chain, however, he turned abruptly to the left along El Wad and then turned left again on Via Dolorosa. Near the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, he entered a doorway, walked across the room, and knocked at a second door. After a moment, the door opened and a hand pulled him inside. Without saying a word, the heavily robed figure placed a hood over his head, shielding what little vision he might have had, and led him through a maze of corridors. When the hood was removed, he found himself in a chamber where a candle revealed an opening in the floor. A wooden ladder descended into the rock. The figure pulled back the cloth from around its face, and he saw it was her. She motioned him to follow her down the ladder. At the foot of the ladder, the passageway continued its downward slope, then leveled off before reaching an open room that glowed with a dim blue light. He caught the smell of incense and the faint strains of a female vocal choir. He looked at the pillared walls and the perfectly formed statue in surprise. "Where are we?" he asked. "Beneath the Church of the Holy Sepulchre," she said. "It stands on a spot previously occupied by a temple to Aphrodite, erected by the Roman Emperor Hadrian. This underground room, forgotten and hence preserved, is all that remains of the original temple." He thought about the guided tour he had taken through the church above, in which was located Golgotha, the place of Jesus' crucifixion as well as Jesus' tomb. A guide with candy on his breath had showed him a hole in the rock that, the guide said, marked the exact spot where Jesus' cross had stood. He had declined the guide's suggestion. He inserted his hand into the hole. He had, however, touched the headstone of Jesus' tomb for a special blessing after a priest had thrust a small cross and a flower into his palm. He had gotten the message, "If you don't want to donate, don't visit our church." The guide had then shown him the key to the church's main door. The key was left in the hands of a neutral Muslim family to avoid jealousy among the Christian factions: Armenian, Greek, Orthodox, Roman Catholic, Coptic, Syrian, and Abyssinian, who shared property rights to the enclosed holy spots. He felt a tightness in his chest as he gazed on the statue of Aphrodite, then looked at the opposite wall, which was clearly of recent construction. "Come," she said, "and I will show you the newly restored functional area of the temple." She turned a key in what appeared to be a door of solid copper, and they stepped into a warm, incense-filled room, which was dimly illuminated by colored lights reflecting off the walls and casting their hues onto the patches of steam floating in the air. The ceiling was formed of pieces of mirrored glass fitted at varying angles to generate an undulatory kaleidoscope. He did not recognize the language of the choir, but the music had a haunting, sensuous quality. She bade him relax on a small pile of cushions. The attendants will tell you what to do. He watched her leave through another door, then looked about him carefully. He monitored his internal senses, but felt no danger. Even the tension that had dogged him constantly from his arrival at Ben-Gurion Airport was gone. He noticed a decorated Greek vase on a small table. He got up to look more closely and saw it was a picture of a naked hetaera standing, but leaning forward with head down. A man was entering her from behind. Curtains parted and a young girl clad only in a short terry cloth robe stepped inside, carrying a goblet on a silver platter. He suddenly felt overdressed in the heat of the room. She kneeled beside him, holding out the platter. He took the goblet and lifted it to his lips. It was warm red wine, surprisingly good. She smiled encouragingly at his small sips, so he qualified the remainder and returned the goblet to the tray. In a moment, the attendant had returned with the cup refilled and with another girl. This time, the tray was set by his side, and the two girls began to help him out of his clothes. They wrapped a large towel around his body, then left him to finish the wine. The dim light had taken on a bright crystalline pattern, and the smell of incense had become strongly erotic. He realized the wine contained a psychedelic. The liquid spread soothingly throughout his body, and he settled deeper into the cushions. He recalled William Blake's reference to the soul's five windows, and noted his own had grown larger, sucking in a rich bouillabaisse of light, sound, taste, touch, and smell. After an indeterminate interval, the two girls returned and led him into an adjacent room with a large sunken bath. When he was fully immersed, they disrobed and joined him on either side. They rubbed his body with soap. He leaned back against the slope wall of the bath, enjoying the exquisite touch of their fingers on his muscles. He was some ancient creature floating on the ocean surface, the sun warming his skin. Then an electric shock went through him when the hands began to lather him, his private parts, temporarily jolting him back into the exterior world. One of the nymphs smiled at him and looked at the curve of her brow, and he looked at the curve of her brow, the delicate neck, etc. She looked something like Teresa that day hiking along the crest of the hills when she had leaned back against a large rock, laughing, taunting him to take her into the bright sunlight. So that's what he had done, slipping off her panties and lifting her dress to press against her, later turning his head to the side to look over the Mediterranean. And I'm editing this quite a bit here, folks. Just wanting to paint the picture here, according to the magician. Now the video was rolling as they rinse off the soap and begin to methodically cover him with a clear perfumed liquid. He sees the pavement rushing toward him as the car weaves through the Judean hills on the road to Beersheba. At the West Bank checkpoint, the soldiers look at the plates on the car and wave him on through. He passes by rocky hills, seeing occasional roadside produce stands and young boys and donkeys herding goats and sheep, till he turns off at Hebron, the place, the burial place of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, where David is anointed king and lives for a time with his six wives, but he is not here to see the monuments. Then they lead him through an entrance surrounded with myrtle branches into a third room with a floor covered with thick rugs and bid him kneel on a small cushion. He realizes he is in the principal room of the temple. It feels vaguely familiar, the floor around him strewn with rose petals. He sits back on his heels with his hands on his knees. The room is dark save for a muted light that silhouettes a statue of Aphrodite. This one is life-size, larger than the one he sees on the split screen of previous time, the light going out for a moment, then reappearing. He can see a faint aura around the statue of the goddess, and he shifts his head to see it better from the side of his eyes, then feels the surge of adrenaline. as the statue moves. The room becomes somewhat lighter as the goddess approaches, and he can see her skin glistening with a light coating of oil. He runs his eyes over her torso, the breasts full, the belly perfectly formed. He drops his gaze to the thighs that seem to sparkle with gold. She is stopped a few inches away, smiling down at him. He stares at her, feeling the heat from her body, smelling her sex. Lines echo in his consciousness. His own words? Someone close to him? Stab your demoniac. Smile to my brain. Soak me in cognac. Beep and cocaine. He is on fire. In other circumstances, he might feel ridiculous kneeling like this, a projection from his own body pointed in the air, now seemingly too expansive, like a terracotta lamp of Priapus with its extended, exaggerated phallus. The end set aflame and hung in a doorway telling evil spirits to beep off. But he is here to worship, and by goddess, that's what he intends to do. As she speaks to him with words he does not understand, and the voice of the choir rises, he reaches out, grasping her hips, pulling her forward, and runs his tongue over and into the golden hair. She places her hands on his head and then sits and lays back as he works his way upward to her lips. Her lips melt away like a soft marshmallow sauce, then return firmer, and she is biting his lower lip. Now he has fused with this goddess. As she wraps her legs around him, he realizes he is no longer certain of the boundaries of his own body. Slipping down the side of the mountain into deeper and deeper snow, this winter's crazy stunt. The snow is suddenly up to his chest, then a whoosh as it collapses beneath him. He is holding himself wedged against the icy walls of the crevice, looking down, straining, ripping off a glove with his teeth, and clawing at the rock, trying to pull himself up and out, his feet kicking uselessly below. The agony of working upward a half inch at a time, a shouted primal defiance of gravity pulling him down. Then, the sudden knowledge that slowly, slowly he will make it, finally rolling out to the side, and being flooded with the terror that there is no feeling in his hand. He plunges it inside his clothing against his chest until finally the first searing needles spread through his fingers. The tension still builds. He is at the exam, his senior year, having worked all night with only an hour's sleep. He notes with satisfaction the logical working of his mind, producing the answers in lockstep fashion. Until he looks at the clock and realizes he is actually in slow motion, working at a rate that will allow him to finish half the questions at best. Everything is there, the insights, the recall of facts, the intuitive sense of the expected answer. No mental blocks, no panic at unfamiliar material. Just the overwhelming fear that he is going to fail because his mind is working too slowly. Straining at his brain, a special kind of mental pressure that he exerts in dreams, when he is flying, holding himself aloft and moving forward as though propelled down an inclined plane, but keeping a uniform distance above the earth. Making his mind work faster, his hand write faster, looking at the clock, feeling a dull fire running up and down his back until out of the blue on the last question, there isn't the slightest turnescence. He is suddenly convulsed into orgasm. He sits there in surprise, then looks guiltily at the surrounding students still immersed in their exams and wonders how he is going to hide the stain on his trousers as he leaves the room. In the Pacific, off Malibu, he feels the motion toward the shore. He has never spent enough time at this to be any good at it, but now, miraculously, with no need to paddle, the board is moving forward, upward, following the swell of the building wave. He is standing as the foamy wave crests, a wave You never get Malibu, and looking at the watery canyon below, his feet like magnets drawing the board into him until it becomes a living extension of his body. Now he begins the downward slice through the liquid, the soul of his board adjusting to subtle shifts in pressure, and he accelerates, riding the foam. The exquisite pleasure surges through the neural network, delivering a lusty joy to the outposts of his body, and he realizes all his life he has been waiting for this one moment, this one supreme second when he is completely attuned to the rhythm of life and the forward motion of the universe. Then, as he rides the wave, the spray rising up around him, he feels a special tightness in his chest, a tension like he's physically contracting his pectorals, but not that. His armpits are like hooks grasping at the air flowing around him. Then he catches the flow and rises off the board. He is flying, surfing the air, exactly like the dreams, except now he is fully awake. He looks down at the curiously entwined bodies, which disappear as he rises through the thick clouds and out into the starry blackness. He cruises the edge of space, the planet above and below him, absorbed in its retrograde motion. And he knows now this is what it is all about. Here, in the open frontier, he is free at last. Now, that is the conclusion of part six, and I'm going to give us a chance to contemplate what we just heard. And I edited the heck out of that, I have to tell you. But it's important to know that that these people who were developing these rockets had metaphysical experiences, and some of them were actually taken to Israel to have those, taken to what would normally have been sacred ground. And he describes what goes on in the catacombs of these temples. I suppose that is a sudden drop shot. We'll be right back. Was Ricky Peterson and Drop Shot. That's the one that knocks you down, okay? From the perspective of what we have covered in this, I suppose chapters 5, which I did not read, and chapter 6, which I edited heavily to keep this a clean show, focus on the experience at this party that the investigators, who were hired by TransGlobal, attended. And these are people who are liberating themselves from the constraints of government. And it, in and of itself, is a very strange situation. It parallels what goes on in the satanic organizations, and that someone was hallucinating. You can imagine what they would have put in the drugs, I mean, in the drinks that were served at this party. And so what we heard basically was an hallucination, but one must question if these drugs are leading one into a realm of spiritual evil or just spiritual chaos in a way. So we have the crazy ones investigating the crazy ones. We have people who are uninhibited in their daily activities, serious about the investigation, but just as willing to go off on a tangent and explore altered states of consciousness for whatever purpose. I guess it's just escapism. So you have to wonder what impact this is ultimately going to have on the rest of the investigation. Remember, this individual was a stockbroker and he became an investigator. He became a detective and he was hired probably because he knew the ins and outs of certain companies, maybe, or maybe Maybe he had some of his own intuition, but certainly he had an altered state of consciousness and was hallucinating. That's what we heard. In the next chapter, which we'll be covering this coming Thursday, it gets back into the details. But don't think that what I read to you, as risque as it might have sounded, didn't have anything to do with this whole group of people. Because I can tell you in my own research today, many years later, now this investigation is going on in the, let's say, circa 1987. And the people involved, especially in the next chapter, are going to do some really questionable things, and it's going to start connecting all the dots in this story as to who Jack Parsons was, who was against him, or who was jealous of him, or who wanted to take full credit for his technology. And eventually cause his death and get away with it. Now, we can speculate who that might be. I could tell you right now that the government is the most likely culprit. And here you have an organization that really doesn't want to identify itself. So is this group Trans Global? In 1987, is that the Illuminati? Is that one of their secret military industrial complex corporations? Just who are they? Well, I think that will become clear as the story goes on. And it has everything to do with what's going on today, I can tell you. It's already brought religion into question, let's say organized religion, and now we have a cult group that was formed by Jack Parsons, who was worshiping an astute follower of Aleister Crowley, and it's going to become very interesting because some power struggles begin to take place in the next chapter, and we'll be listening to that next Thursday. Well, we're out of time. I want to thank you for tuning in. If you missed last Friday night's archive with Jim Murray and Z.S. Livingstone, I urge you to listen to it. Listen to it carefully. Consider what we talked about, because basically what we did is we took you backwards from the nuclear explosion at the Fukushima nuclear power plant. We took you backwards to the earthquake. And I think you'll find it fascinating how we connected the dots. And I'm told that we hit the nail right on the head. It was a bullseye. Something to consider. It actually has everything to do with this story, too. So until tomorrow night, I want to wish everyone a good night. Thank Wind Talkers Radio Network for broadcasting Evident Footprints. We had Don Newsom on the sound tonight. I'd like to thank Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, and you, the listening audience, for tuning in. My scheduled guest for tomorrow is Dr. Wayne Pickering. In the meantime, I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.